Been a while. Randy this morning mentioned that it had been a couple of weeks since he was preaching, and it's been a couple of weeks since we have not met on Sunday night. So where we are in this story of Judges, we're still in Judges 6, which is part of the story of Gideon, as the Lord raises up Gideon to save Israel. And tonight we're going to be in verses 25 to 32, just 8 verses, and I've just put a title on that: Gideon Begins to Save Israel, which sounds like a strange statement to us, to save Israel, that he would save Israel. In chapter 2, The explanation of this repeating cycle of the judges, we read this: whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. So it's the Lord who raises up the judge in chapter 2, 18, and it's the Lord who saves the people. He saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. So we might feel uncomfortable saying something like Gideon saves Israel. And I would probably never say something like, well, I had a friend and shared the gospel with him and I saved him. I would never do that, right? So you probably wouldn't do that either. I'd say something like the Lord saved him. But the last couple of Sunday nights that we were here, we had something called the Call of Gideon, where, if you remember, the angel of the Lord comes to visit him, comes to talk to Gideon. Gideon doesn't respond well, but the angel does say this to him: and the Lord turned to him and said, so this is the Lord now, as the angel of the Lord is there, go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do I not send you? So the Lord tells Gideon to save Israel. Gideon isn't really comfortable with the idea that he can save Israel either. But this doesn't mean that the Lord isn't saving Israel. Here's how Gideon responds. And he said to him, please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house, youngest in my father's house, probably. And the Lord said to him, but I will be with you. That's how you save Israel. And you shall strike the Midianites as one man. So that's how he would save Israel, because the Lord is with him. But it's still not wrong to say that Gideon is the one who saves Israel. The Lord is still saving Israel, but Gideon is his instrument that he uses. Gideon saving Israel is something like the Apostle Paul says, when he says this: I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. So he doesn't think that he has the power of salvation, but he knows he is the Lord's instrument in what he does. So that's where we were in Judges 6, verse 16, and then we ended Judges 6:24, three weeks ago, actually. Then Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it, the Lord is peace. And to this day, it stands at Ophrah, which belongs to the Abiezrites. So that's where we ended last time. We'll pick up there. From there, this next verse is Judges 6:25. That's where we're going to start tonight. So we're ready for Israel to begin saving Israel. But this story is different from the ones that we've had so far in this way. it doesn't begin with the judge, or the one that the Lord raises up, attacking the oppressor to save Israel. It doesn't start that. It doesn't start there. Where it starts is at home for Gideon, where the root cause is of the Lord handing the Israelites over to the Midianites. They did evil in the eyes of the Lord, which means that they were worshiping other gods, specifically mentioned sometimes Baal and Asherah. That's where he's starting, quite literally for Gideon, at home, in his hometown, in his father's house. That's where he starts to save Israel. And it begins with a command from the Lord. And this text breaks down very nicely into four parts. The Lord commands, and then Gideon responds to that, to the Lord's command, in obedience, by the way. And then the men of the city, I think the ESV says town, but the men of the city respond to Gideon's obedience. And then Gideon's father, whose name is Joash, responds to the men of the city. And this is only 8 verses long, so we'll read through it before we start to break it down. So Judges 6, 25 to 32. That night, the Lord said to him, "Take your father's bull and the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold there, with stones laid in due order. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah that you shall cut down." So Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had told him. But because he was too afraid of his family and the men of the town to do it by day, he did it by night. And when the men of the town arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was broken down, and the Asherah beside it was cut down. And the second bull was offered on the altar that had been built. And they said to one another, "Who has done this thing?" And after they had searched and inquired, they said, "Gideon the son of Joash has done this thing." Then the men of the town said to Joash, "Bring out your son, that he may die, for he has broken down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah beside it." But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Will you contend for Baal, or will you save him? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down." Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Yerubbaal, that is to say, "Let Baal contend against him, because he broke down his altar." Okay, back to verse 25. The Lord commands. That night, the Lord said to him. So that night might be the same night after the angel appeared to him and called him to save Israel. For sure it would. I think we can confidently say it would have been that night, the night that following when he set up the altar that he named "The Lord is Peace" in the last in verse 24. That night, whenever he set that altar up, however long that took, that night the Lord said to him, and that night the Lord commanded him, you could say too, that night he said to him, he commanded him, and as we shall see, the Lord makes this command very clear, exactly what he wants him to do. Take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old. So we're not yet in the part of the story that talks about Gideon's father, how he responds, but we can learn a lot from about Gideon's father in this verse. Remember that Gideon said that his family was the least in Manasseh. That was just a nicety. That was just what he was supposed to say, to be seen as humble. So coming into this night, we know that that the Lord commanded Gideon. We already knew this. In Judges 6:11, it says, "Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press." So he was a landowner. He had this land where this place was where you could sit. He had a wine press. He probably had a threshing floor because he was only using the wine press to hide the grain from the Midianites. Now we see that Joash has livestock, specifically bulls, probably for work and for breeding, probably got others. As we're going to see in a few minutes, he has lots of servants. Joash is wealthy. He's by no means the least in the tribe of Manasseh. Joash has built an altar to Baal and an Asherah pole and pulled down the altar of Baal that your father has and cut down the Asherah that is beside it. So Baal, again, is one of the main gods of the Canaanites. He would have been considered the god of weather, the god of storms, Asherah, the fertility goddess. And so there would be natural things, natural gods for the Canaanites to worship. They were crop people, many of them. So they cared about rain, and they cared about fertility. And so many of the Canaanites worship these gods. There were other Canaanite gods, many other Canaanite gods, but predominantly at this time and in this area, Baal and Asherah. So an altar to Baal and then a pole, it would be a pole to, it would be the Asherah, an Asherah pole, some kind of a wooden structure for the goddess Asherah. What does that tell us about Joash? Well, he is fully absorbed into the Canaanite culture. Gideon's father, Joash, was part of the problem. He was the problem in his city. He was doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, the reason that the Lord had brought this oppression on Israel is because of this, exactly because of these kind of things. So Gideon's charge to save Israel starts right here, right in his hometown, right in his father's house. And yet, so he's got this Asherah pole, he's got this altar to Baal, and yet I think from what happens later in this story, If you kind of read the story and try to figure out what's going on here, even though he had a place of pagan worship, it seems to me this was a marriage of convenience. He was wealthy. And to become and to stay wealthy in a culture, in that culture, he went along to get along. That's what it looks like. If as you go through this story, that's what kind of a person Joash was. We don't know for sure. Maybe he was a fully committed Baal worshiper at the start of this story, but then again, from the text and what's written in the text, he probably just subscribed to that idea. You have to go along to get along. It was a business relationship for him. So in America, in the United States, it used to be good for business to be a member of a church. But for many people, the commitment to us was to the business and not to the church. Now, in Sioux Falls, it still might be good for business if you're a member of a church, in certain circles anyway. But in many places in America, that is not true. And in many places in America, church attendance is very, very low. East Coast cities like Boston, etc. But it isn't necessarily a good thing for people to go casually to church, just to go for business purposes. And so those people are all out of the churches too. So Joash was probably expected as a wealthy person in the town to provide a place of worship for the community. And so he had an altar to Baal, and he had an Asherah pole next to it. It was good for business. So the Lord commands Gideon to take his father's bull and to pull down his father's altar to Baal with his father's bull, and then to cut down the Asherah pole that was stood beside it. I love the literal translation of this in Hebrew text. It just brings out this point of what he's actually doing. He says, "Take the bull." It's a more literal way to say it. "Take the bull, the one that belongs to your father. And the second bull 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal, the one that belongs to your father." That's the way that reads. And then the Lord commands Gideon, "And build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold here, with stones laid in due order." So on top of the stronghold here, does anybody have a different translation from that? I think that's also, this is the ESV. I think New American Standard also says stronghold there. I know other versions don't. Anybody have one? New American Standard does. It's built on the word for strength, no doubt about it. It means like a place of safety or security. It's sometimes used as a refuge, something like that. But it's a place that's safe. It's a place that's secure. It's a place that is strong. It's probably at or near the place that the altar of Baal was. It's a secure place. So Gideon wasn't only supposed to tear down the altar to Baal, he's also to replace it with an altar to the Lord. So he couldn't leave up the altar of Baal and just plant a new altar next to it, an altar to the Lord. That would be an abomination to the Lord, wouldn't it? Just think about the commandment. You shall have no other gods before me, or in my presence, or if you want to take it, upon my face would be another way to say it. You shall have no other gods in my face, you might say in our modern language. Just, I am not going to be beside any other gods. That would have been okay, by the way, with the Canaanites, probably. They are fine with multiple gods, but not with the Lord. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood on the Asherah that you shall cut down. So take the wood from the Asherah pole, cut it up, put it on the altar, the new altar that you've made, and offer up that bull, the second bull, the seven-year-old bull, on there. The Lord is God, and there is no other. There can't be anything else left beside him. And here's how Gideon then responds to the Lord's command. And it only, in this passage of 8 verses, it only takes one. But that one verse says a lot. So Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had told him. So Gideon has servants. He's, again, they're not by any means the least among the families of Manasseh. He has servants, apparently a lot of them, so he's probably very wealthy, well-to-do. Literally this way, and Gideon took 10 men from his servants. So he's got servants. Gideon has a lot of servants. But the important thing is, in this first sentence, is, as the Lord had told him. Gideon has gone from being what appears to be like a sarcastic young man who kind of, as he answers the angel back, doubts that the Lord is really with Israel, or how could this happen? Almost, you know, like a smart aleck kid, it seems like. He's gone from that to somebody who does as the Lord commands. It's truly a remarkable transformation. But then again, it did take being convinced by the angel of the Lord to make that change. But that isn't all this verse tells us about Gideon's response. Because he was too afraid of his family and the men of the town to do it by day, he did it by night. So Gideon is afraid. He wasn't initially afraid of the angel of the Lord. He was able to answer him back. But he is afraid of his father's household. Family, it says here, his father's household. And he's afraid of the men of the city, or the men of the town, as the ESV puts it. So it's easy to see why he might be afraid of his father, isn't it? He'd torn down his father's altar, cut down the Asherah pole that belonged to his father, most likely. Had taken two of his bulls, killed one, sacrificed one. But he was also afraid of the people of the city, the men of the town, as the ESV puts it. He was afraid of the community. He was afraid of the people that you really need to go along with to get along. You really got to get along with these people. Israel had become Canaanized. So this isn't like simply like peer pressure that people face. This is more than that. It was dangerous to go against them, as we read here. But because he was too afraid of his family and or the house of his father's house and the man of the town to do it by day, he did it by night. So just last week, Easter, Resurrection Sunday, as I was thinking about this passage, it reminded me of Joseph of Arimathea. How was that? Well, here's why. It's only recorded this way in the Gospel of John. John's the only one that mentions this part. John 19:38. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took away his body. Joseph of Arimathea, in all the Gospels, he's in all of them. Secret disciple because he's afraid. Afraid of the Jews. A secret disciple of Jesus. But notice this, he could not stay that way. He could not stay a secret disciple. He couldn't forever keep it a secret. In fact, probably at one of the most dangerous times, he reveals it. He goes to Pilate after Jesus has been crucified and says, "Can I have his body?" He reveals who he is, what he is like. For some reason, he couldn't hide it anymore. We're not given any more insight into that. But for some reason, he's a secret disciple. He was a secret disciple. So if you're a secret disciple, really, you're not going to be able to hide that forever. It must necessarily come out. It has to come out. Why? Why does it have to come out? Why did Joseph of Arimathea have to do that? I don't know his story behind the scenes. We're not given very much information. This last week, I'm in a study with a group, Bible study with a group. We're studying the Sermon on the Mount with Martin Lloyd-Jones. But I wrote this beside on in the book, in the chapter that we were studying this week, Secret Disciples. So here's what Martin Lloyd-Jones writes. This is in the chapter called Blessed Are the Meek, as we're studying this, the Sermon on the Mount. Once more, then, we're reminded at the very beginning that a Christian is altogether different from the world. It is a difference in quality, an essential difference. He is a new man, a new creation. He belongs to an entirely different kingdom. And not only is the world unlike him, it cannot possibly understand him. He is an enigma to the world. And if you and I are not, in this primary sense, problems and enigmas to the non-Christians around us, then this tells us a great deal about our profession of the Christian faith. Christians are altogether different. You can't hide that. When you start following what the Lord tells you to do, you can't hide that. You're altogether different from the rest of the world. Years ago, this was before I knew Bob Larson on the over here. He was there before I was. I was on the fire department. I got to the fire department. I thought I was the only believer there. I didn't know Bob. Turns out there were a few others, but it was highly unpopular to be a believer on the fire department. Bob may have felt that same way when he started. I don't know, but I did. But I couldn't hide it, right? People knew. They just knew. How do they know? When I heard about Bob, I knew he was a believer. So that goes back many years now. But you can't, you're entirely different. We're called to be entirely different. And Gideon, to obey the Lord, had to be entirely different from the rest of the people. If you're going to be faithful to the Lord and do as the Lord commands you to do, like Gideon, you're not going to be able to hide that for very long. Christians, like Martin Lloyd-Jones says, the Christian is altogether different from the world. The men of the city respond. When the men of the town rose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was broken down, and the Asherah beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar that had been built. So they wake up to this unexpected sight. But they noticed. It was pretty easy for them to notice. The altar of Baal was torn down. The Asherah pole was gone. And there was a new altar, and I'm sure there was a smoldering bull that was still on the altar. They couldn't miss it. And they said to one another, who has done this thing? That's the first thing they want to know. Who did this? Who tore down our altar? That belonged to Gideon's father, by the way. And after they had searched and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. So the ESV and everybody else that translates this, and they're good translations, they kind of slow down this series of verbs that is in this clause before Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. Clauses, I should say. So ESV, again, excellent translation, but I think a literal reading from the Hebrew will send you a different picture of what this looked like. Here's the whole verse. And each said to his neighbor, who did this thing? And they searched and they inquired and they said. That's just it. Three verbs in a row like that. And they searched and they inquired and they said. That's three words in Hebrew, by the way. And they searched is one, and they inquired, and they said. Three words in Hebrew. Back to back to back. Gideon couldn't hide it, what he had done. First of all, there were 10 witnesses, right? He brought 10 servants. So he couldn't hide it for some reason, but he couldn't hide it. He couldn't have kept it secret very long, because he was following what the Lord told him to do. So he doesn't keep it very long. He's afraid going in, but he's unable to do it. If you're going to obey the Lord, you're going to be altogether different from the culture around you, from the world around you. Then the man of the town said to Joash, so here's how they react once they know it's Gideon. Bring out your son that he may die. So don't forget, these are probably Israelites or a combination of Israelites with Canaanites that were living among them. It's probably a group of Israelites who are saying, bring out your son that he may die. So essentially, so we can kill him. Bring out your son so we can kill him, because his great crime is he's torn down the altar of Baal. These are Israelites saying, let's kill him. He tore down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah beside it, the very thing that the Lord commanded him and had commanded all of Israel when they were coming into the promised land. When you get there, break down all the altars and cut down all the Asherah poles. Destroy them all. This was a command for all Israel. And when somebody does it, the Israelites in town say, let's kill him. That's a picture of being just completely absorbed by the Canaanite culture. They were Israelites living in a post-Yahweh worship culture, in a post-Yahweh worship world. They had moved on to something else. Just, I guess it seems like a long time ago, but it was just yesterday morning as we were meeting in our Greek-Hebrew group via Zoom. That's the way we do it now. But we got on this discussion of the new proposed legislation in Canada, which is that it's a hate speech. It's hate speech legislation being proposed by the Prime Minister's party, so it'll have a lot of support. Who knows? It'll probably pass. I don't know. I don't know Canadian politics that well. But here's what it is. Essentially, anybody that says anything that might harm somebody else, that's hate speech and it's illegal, including things like, and we're not going to exempt religious texts or interpretations of the texts. That's what it is. They took that part out that said that you could do that. If this legislation passes. In other words, if you read the Bible and somebody's offended, you can be charged with hate speech. If you read the Bible aloud and somebody's offended by it, and I guarantee they wrote it so that the Bible would be covered, you will be guilty of a crime in Canada if this passes. And we got on this discussion and just talking about it because Randy remembers going to high school, junior high. Which was it? Pardon? High school. High school in Canada. Randy went there in the morning. I think he's talked about this on Sunday mornings before. In the morning, at the start of school, they read the Lord's Prayer over the loudspeaker in school in Canada. In high school, when Randy was in high school, in his lifetime, you may be able to be prosecuted for that. In one lifetime. They are living in a post-Christian world. People will be demanding prosecution for things like reading the Lord's Prayer. And the discussion went this way as well. So how far away are we from that? Well, Canada doesn't have free speech in their constitution. But we do, which gives us comfort. We're two probably Supreme Court justices away from something like that. It's how the Constitution is interpreted. We're not that far away from that. We know we live in a post-Christian world. This isn't an effort to scare stuff. It's just that, say, we need to watch out for the culture around us because the culture around us can swallow us up like it's doing in Canada. And that's what Judges is meant to teach us. That this can happen where you are, so don't fall for it. Be ready for it. Don't become like the culture around you. By the way, the Canaanites don't even mention in this thing the Israelites that are acting like Canaanites, they don't even mention that, oh, and by the way, you put up this altar to the Lord. They only care that you tore down the altar to Baal and to Asherah and the Asherah pole. The Lord is so insignificant in this story to them that that's not the big part of it. It means nothing to them that all of a sudden there's an altar there to the Lord compared to the fact that you tore down the altar of Baal. So how does Joash, Gideon's father, then respond to them when they say, bring him out so that we can kill him? But Joash said to all who stood against him, so they probably thought that Joash would be sympathetic to them. After all, it was his altar. It was his Asherah pole. Joash had killed one of his bulls and put it on another. It was his son. Send your son out so that he can be put to death, so that he can die. Because he has committed this abominable act against Baal. But Joash, I mean, almost surprisingly, considers that standing against him. Joash said to all who stood against him, it might just be loyalty to family. That's a pretty strong force, being loyal to your family. But he'd been in this culture a long time. And if he's going along to get along and he's making a lot of money from it, family might mean something, but it might not mean everything. But he's not willing to continue to pretend, it looks like, that he's a true Baal worshiper. Because no true Baal worshiper would respond this way. Will you contend for Baal? Or will you save him? So just think about those questions. What do they say about Joash? Probably more importantly, what do they say about Baal? Will you contend for him? Seems like he needs somebody to contend for him. Will you save him? Well, does God call us to contend for him? No. I mean, in the wilderness, Israel contended with God, not contended for him. They contended with him. Does God call on us to save him? I don't think so. But that reminded me of this post that I got from, that I saw on, this is the reason I stay on what used to be Twitter, but now on, now called X, because John Piper's on there, and I like to see these things that he put on there. But he put on this, I think it was a couple of years ago, he goes through his Bible in a year, and as he's reading along, he'll post something about a verse that he read or something like that. And he happened to be in 1 Samuel 31, like again, I think this was a couple years ago, and commented on these verses. And the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that would be Saul and his son after he killed him, and Jonathan after they killed him. And they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. So what did Piper grab out of that? Latch onto that. Here's what he latched onto. And they carried the good news to the house of their God. They brought good news to their gods. They brought the good news to their gods. Their gods didn't bring good news to them, like our God does. They're different things, right? Our God doesn't need us to contend for him. Our God doesn't call us to save him. What kind of God does that? No God at all. The ones that have ears and don't hear, eyes and don't see. Those are the gods. Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. So Joash has completely turned the tables on the men of the city here, hasn't he? Said, if you're going to contend for him, you'll be the ones that are put to death. Now, was that simply family loyalty? I don't think so. Joash has to be wondering or even thinking or maybe thought for a long time, these guys really don't have any power at all. Otherwise, he wouldn't say, and if he actually thought they did, he wouldn't do that kind of thing. Say, if you're going to contend for Baal, I'll put you to death. We don't know. God knows where he was and where he ended up. We don't know. The story doesn't tell us. But what he thought, even what Joash thought, comes out. And he couldn't any longer play along with it. Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down. It seems like he gets the picture pretty clearly. Joash does. Gideon's father. If he's a god, let him fight for himself, basically, because his altar has been broken down. Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Jerubbaal. More literally, again, it says, and he called him on that day Jerubbaal. And he called him on that day Jerubbaal. So that would be Joash then. Joash called him. Joash is the one that changed his name, which seems to fit with how Joash is portrayed in this story. And he called him that because, that is to say, let Baal contend against him. So Jerubbaal means let Baal contend, or Baal will contend. That's what that name means. So why would it say let Baal contend against him? What is that saying? Well, against him isn't part of the name. So this clause is an explanation of the name Jerubbaal, but against him isn't part of that. Against him is added to the name. But the explanation for why he puts that in there, let Baal contend against him, is because of this. Against him, because he broke down the altar. So he's saying, not only let Baal contend for himself, but let him contend against my son. Let him fight against my son. Let Baal fight against my son. And we're in the story of Gideon, who was called to save Israel. Let Baal fight against Gideon. That's what he is saying. Now, if he thought Baal had any real power, he wouldn't have said that, would he? But that is the story. of what is coming up with Gideon. Let Baal contend with him or fight against him or contend against him. So what we see here is that this is how Gideon begins to send to save Israel. The Lord puts this all in motion with a command. Sets this whole thing in motion with a command. People respond to it. And by the end of it, you have people who, the guy who has an altar saying essentially, Baal has no strength at all. So Gideon does begin to save Israel. He's God's instrument to save Israel, beginning at home. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for your word to us. Thank you that you are a God who does not need us to contend for him or to save him, but you are the God who contends for us and saves us. Pray that you'd be with us this week. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.